Anubis, Serapis, Set, Tot, Khnum, and Horus all turned at the rustle of coarse cloth. From beneath their helmets, they stared imperiously at the two men shuffling out of the storage shanty. They ignored the ragged figure of Danielson and focused their attention on the slightly built, sallow-faced man, timidly edging out into the hot blast of sunlight.
Who's this Phoebus, Sorkin?
He arrived here from across the barrens, O mighty incarnation of the Guardian of the Underworld.
What's your name, Phoebe?
Name's Dix. I lost my way from a trading party. Wandered for days. Ended up here.
Who else was with you, Dix?
A couple more. They died in the desert.
We found the tracks of at least five people. Maybe more.
I don't know nothing about that. Maybe you miscalculated. Terrible fierce storm last night. Maybe messed up the ground.
We know all about the storm, pissant. Sorkin, was there a red-haired woman with him?
Answer us, you old fool. Who else was with him?
Me.
A big, scar-faced man with a black patch over his left eye stepped from a narrow alley between two shacks. The auto weapon in his fist was as rock-steady as his voice.
And me.
A slender figure emerged from behind another shack, his body swathed in white linen folds. Intense ruby-red eyes stared out from an unnaturally pale face. The satin finish of the 6-inch-long barrel of his revolver reflected the sun in dancing pinpoints.
Me too.
A sturdily built, dark-skinned woman sidled into view, a long-barreled pistol held in a two-fisted grip.
And last, and perhaps the least, though that is purely subjective, is my humble self.
A skinny, silver-haired scarecrow of a man stepped into the street, the hollow bores of his double-barreled gun fixed on them like hollow dead eyes. JB made a casual move as if to adjust his clothing, and an Uzi connected to his neck by a lanyard appeared in his right hand. The incarnates were surrounded, outflanked by unwavering gun barrels. They stared in disbelief, and something more than disbelief. They were shocked into speechless immobility. JB mentally congratulated himself at his hurriedly concocted plan to divert the helmeted men while his friends went out the back of the storage building and took up positions around them had been accomplished very smoothly. Knowing that Christie Smith and Wesson and Dean's Browning High Power were trained on the so-called incarnates from inside the building made him feel even better.
This isn't necessary. We mean you no harm.
Yeah, right.
You're sec men. Sec men for hell eyes.
Heresy. We are the servants in the City of Truth, sworn to serve the First Kingdom and the glorious dynasty of Akhenaten.
A glorious dynasty? You are invited to play a part in its destiny!
Not a very significant part, of course, but it's far better than being left out of it altogether.
Take off those helmets and drop your giggers.
That we will not do. You will put up your arms and come with us. You will not be harmed. My word of honor on it.
Do what I say or I'll show you where you stand. My word of honor on it.
The V of the slim rod in Khnum's hand shifted slightly. In the tiny tick of time before and after the blink, Ryan's eye registered a flash of light, like an errant reflection of the sun. The shock of the blow, which wasn't just a physical impact, picked him up, flung him back, and bowled him over. He fell as limp and cold as a corpse to the sandy ground. Christie fired and struck Khnum in the center of his bare back. The ram-headed man flailed forward, a small, blue-rimmed hole sprouting in the hollow of his spine. The Mata'u shafts in the hands of the incarnates flicked back and forth, spitting little white flares of light. Doc twisted his lean body in a painful contortion as a thread of miniature lightning passed very close by him. He squeezed the trigger of his Lama. And a clump of deadly 18-gauge grapeshot ripped into the flat-muscled abdomen of Set. JB depressed the trigger of his Uzi, but nothing happened. He instantly realized that sand had worked his way into the gun, fouling the trigger and firing pin. The double prongs of a Mata'u rod swept toward him. What saved him from ending up like Ryan was a wild jostle from Danielson.
No! Stop this!
At the same second, Christie and Dean bolted from the doorway of the building, pushing Danielson out of their path. Light flashed, but the energy bolt cleaved nothing but air. JB tucked and rolled across the ground, snatching Set's fallen rod. He raised it hastily, surprised by its light weight. He sighted down it, framing Anubis between the V-tip. As with the Uzi, nothing happened. Serapis began a charging run toward the nearest chariot in panic. Jack, Mildred, Christie, and Dean all fired at him. He twisted this way and that before crashing headlong to the ground. The pair of bird-headed incarnates, Horus and Tote, swept their rods in left-to-right arcs. Christie and Dean lunged in opposite directions, each squeezing off a shot as they did so, and missing with both. A nimbus of wavery blue sprang from Danielson's chest. He careened backward, fetching up against the splintery wall of the storage building and sliding down it to the ground. Sighting down the barrel of her ZKR, Mildred triggered a shot at Tote. A splash of blood bloomed on the back of his right hand, and the silver shaft dropped from suddenly nerve-dead fingers. As the crane head pivoted toward Mildred, Christie shot him through the heart. Immediately after, five gun barrels trained on Horus.
Enough! No more or he dies!
The jackal-headed man stood over Ryan's prostrate form, one sandaled foot on his chest, the prongs of his rod touching the hollow of his throat, as if he were planting a victory flag. The five fingers tensed on five triggers, the gun bores dropping slightly. The broad shoulders of Horus sagged briefly in relief, then straightened.
Drop your weapons, or my brother will send this heretic into the care of Ushabti. You, red-haired woman, you are the guest of Pharaoh and will be treated as such.
Do you not understand?
I understand perfectly.
Ryan shot the jackal-headed man between the legs. Anubis released his Mata'u rod so he could clasp at the tatters of his manhood. Jack, Christie, Dean, and Mildred all fired in perfect synchronization at Horus. By the time he fell sideways, there was nothing identifiable remaining of either the hawk or the human head. Ryan struggled to rise, but he only shambled to one knee. His face was covered with sweat, his lungs felt shriveled, and he labored for breath. Although his vision was shot through with swimming gray spots, he saw the death convulsions of Anubis. As Ryan watched, the jackal-headed man's struggles to cling to life ceased. Then the hands of his friends pulled Ryan to his feet. Christie clung to him.
I'm all right.
They led Ryan to a wedge of shadow and lowered him into a sitting position.
Yeah.
Jack offered him a jug of water, and he drank from it long and gratefully. JB scowled at the Mata'u rod in his hands, revolving it between them.
What kind of crazy bastard weapons are these? No trigger, no power source. I couldn't get it to work.
That's because you don't have the training.
They stared in surprise as Danielson approached them, stepping over the eviscerated body of Set.
You chilled them all. Jesus.
That's what happens when you bring frog giggers to gunfights.
I saw you take a direct hit with one of those things. You're not hurt?
This Ankh amulet I wear absorbed and redirected the nerve-traumatizing effect of the Mana energy. Carter always knew you for a nervy bastard, even when you were just a sprout. Your nerves must be made of steel cable.
What do you mean?
I mean you should be lying there chilled, or at the very least comatose and paralyzed.
I didn't miss that last by much. It was like having a live wire connected to a suction pump jammed up my ass. All my strength felt like it was sucked away.
The discordant resonance effect. Your bioenergy harmonies were disrupted. You were stronger than the incarnates figured. And very lucky.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly how I feel.
You've got a story to tell us, old man.
Yeah. Like, how did these overdressed stoops know about Christie?
I can't answer that question. But I'll give up what I know. First, we'd better get the bodies out of sight. There's some damn big buzzards with damn big appetites around here.
Christie and Ryan accompanied Danielson into the storage shed, while J.B., Dean, and Jack dragged the corpse of the incarnates into an outbuilding at the far end of Fort Fubar. The bodies were placed in shallow graves and covered in shrouds of canvas. The helmets proved to be constructed of cunningly crafted wood, inlaid with colored ceramic tiles. The craftsmanship was of a very high order, bordering on the artistic. Mildred and Doc sifted handfuls of sand over the puddles of gore on the ground and policed the area, picking up the Mata'u rods and spent shell casings. JB gave the horseless chariots a quick inspection
feeling a grudging admiration for the design, which was both ornate and functionally elegant. The conveyances were steered by a simple guide bar, the speed controlled by a joystick lever projecting from a very simple gearbox. It took him a minute to figure out the vehicle's motive power. A stacked array of concave mirrored squares occupied an open box at the rear end of the chassis platform. The angle of the mirrors was controlled by a small crank winch. JB knew that some pre-dark industrialists and environmentalists had experimented with ways to convert the sun's energy to electricity with solar cells. The little reflective squares were semiconductor chips and provided power to drive the vehicles. Despite himself, he was impressed with the technology. Still, he couldn't even hazard a guess at the operation of the Mata'u rods. Dean pulled sentry duty in the street while the adults returned to the storage building. Christie spread out one of the sheets, and while JB and Ryan field-stripped their weapons, meticulously oiling and cleaning their moving parts, they posed questions to Danielson.
You built Fort Fubar?
Yeah, about 18 years ago. After Trader gave me the heave-ho, I hooked up with some farers. Rather than scrape around in a barony, I convinced them to come out here with me.
Why? There's nothing out here but sand and sun.
I'd made copies of some of Marsh Folsom's maps, you see.
So you thought there was a stockpile out here in the Barrens?
Yeah. If not a stockpile, then some sort of installation I could use to build a power base. I figured I wouldn't have any competition out here. By the time we got out here and built this place, there was about 50 adults, 10, 12 teenagers and some kids, a couple of babies. I organized us like the way Trader had done. Connie Harrier was my woman and my second in command. My first lieutenant was Mel Stockbridge, and after him was old Javna. After we got the fort built, we spent a few months searching the barrens, looking for the place on the map. By that time, our food was running low. We had to find it or we'd starve. Then one day we found the place, the redoubt, and we found him. Or he found us. Don't know which is which no more.
Found who?
Akhenaten, our pharaoh, our god. He'd been waiting in his tomb for his people, you see. We strolled up and we became his people. Just as simple as that.
And you just let him take over?
I didn't have much choice. Javna tried to throw down on him and he chilled the old fart as easy as swatting a fly. He took Connie into his tomb and did something to her insides so she could bear him children.
Did Connie have red hair and green eyes by chance?
No, her hair was dark. Blue eyes, I think. Hard to remember now. Akhenaten arrived in Fort Fubar with ration packs from the redoubt, which he distributed among the strongest of the farers and the healthiest children. No one resisted him. Rather, they worshipped him almost immediately, their former loyalty to me evaporating like a drop of water in the desert at high noon. Later, when the chosen farers had regained their strength, Akhenaten led them farther into the barrens to excavate his royal city, the city of Aten.
Hold it! Excavated? You mean there was a city already out there?
Oh, yeah. Buried in the sand. But most of it was still intact. Even all the statues.
Wait. You expect us to believe the city of Aten was out there in the desert waiting for him?
That's what I said, isn't it? Anyhow, once the sand was all cleared away, Pharaoh set about making the city livable. Repairing it, fixing it up, establishing our society. He knew ways to irrigate the plains and grow crops. He designed the chariots and the Mata'u rods. He shared all the ancient arts of the people of the Nile with us. It was a happy time, productive and busy. He named me and Stockbridge as high counselors. He took Connie to wife in a ceremony that lasted a week.
And you did not resent having your woman stolen from you?
I've thought about that off and on for the last 16 years. I sure as hell should have been jealous. I remember feeling jealous for a little while, then it went away. It was like I couldn't feel jealous, no matter how hard I tried. What the hell, though? I had three wives and three kids myself. Kind of hard to be too jealous with that kind of diversion.
Phew. How many women for the pharaoh? 100?
Not hardly. He stuck with Connie. He truly seemed to love that woman. When their daughter Nephrin was born, the celebration lasted 2 weeks. For a long time after that, we dwelt in peace in the city. Oh, there were a few disputes with some nomads and roamers who stumbled into our territory. The ones that we didn't chill joined up with us, absorbed by our society. Yeah, for years we dwelt at peace in Aten, doing damn little but eating, drinking, making love, making babies. It was kind of like paradise.
Even a paradise has its price. What were you expected to give Pharaoh in return for this bucolic existence?
The usual. Unswerving, unquestioning obedience and loyalty.
In other words, your free will.
Well, what would you have done, Carter? First of all, Pharaoh has a power, and I've had a long time to study on it and how it works. Pharaoh's power is subtle, an amplified application of will and emotion. The strength of his mind energy requires only a focal point to guide it, a vibration that followed like a torch flame in the wind. If your mind was naked and unguarded, you were immediately under Pharaoh's influence. Even if you were prepared, the influence was so persistent that resistance was eventually eroded away. You're thinking that all of us in Aten are weak-brained fools. You're thinking we let Pharaoh turn me and my people into zombies. Well, that's sort of right and sort of wrong. He gave back as much as he took. He provided us not only with emotional sustenance, but material sustenance. No suffering, no poverty, no going hungry, no night-crawling cold hearts slitting your throat for your shoes. Who wouldn't go along with that? You'd go along with it, too, if you'd been with us. You know why you'd go along with it, Carter? Because you're afraid to die, just like the rest of us zombies. I never believed in any god but myself and a blaster, but I believed in him. And even if Pharaoh is a mutie, spawned in a test tube and not heaven, who gives a shit?
What about Connie Harrier? You said he loved her. Did she love him back, or was she just under his influence?
Doesn't matter. Like I said, when you're in the presence of Pharaoh, you end up loving him eventually. After a few years, Pharaoh decided his dynasty needed a son. To make sure of it, he took Connie back to his tomb, the redoubt, to do something to her. Don't know what, exactly.
Genetic preselection, probably. Prenatal manipulation to determine the sex of the offspring.
Yeah, whatever. Connie died, and something died inside of Pharaoh, too. Pharaoh brought Connie's body back to Aten. The period of mourning went on for months, went on so long that the atmosphere of brooding and grief became the norm. Pharaoh locked himself away in his palace, shutting out his daughter Nephrin, his counselors, and even the needs of his own people. I'm not sure how long Pharaoh's self-imposed exile lasted, but I'm certain that well over 2 years elapsed. Then came the day when Pharaoh emerged. He made several announcements, issued a number of decrees. He claimed that Connie had never been meant to be his mate, that he had been deceived by her. Henceforth, he wouldn't recognize their union, and he wouldn't recognize Nephrin as a legitimate heir to his kingdom. Furthermore, he knew his true queen, his true consort, lay out in the world somewhere, and in order to prepare himself and his kingdom for her arrival, a pyramid in her honor would be erected. Its power would act like a beacon to draw her into his arms. The population was divided. Slaves to build the pyramid and slaves to serve the increasingly erratic whims of Pharaoh. There was much dissatisfaction. The bitterness became a quarrel and then open rebellion. From the rebellion, two factions emerged. Pharaoh and his inner circle of advisors, to which he, Stockbridge, and I belonged, as well as the newly formed security force called the Incarnates. The other faction was led by supporters of Nephrin, at that point a young woman of 14. The rebellion turned from words into a week of bloodshed, murder, and assassination attempts. At the end of that week, the revolution was crushed, ruthlessly. Over 20 people sympathetic to Nephrin died, including one of my wives and two of my children. Despite that, I was still in Pharaoh's favor, since my only son was killed while trying to assassinate me. But I had begun to doubt. I had this made by one of our craftsmen who knew it blocked Pharaoh's power. Most of the rebels had warned them, acting on Nephrin's advice. When construction on the pyramid began, I decided I had had my fill of Aten. About a year ago, I came back here to Fort Fubar, where it all began. I don't know why the Incarnates should be looking for you, young woman, unless Pharaoh thinks you're his true, predestined consort. If that's the case, my advice to all of you is to put as much distance between yourselves and Aten as you can before another search party is sent out.
How long will that be?
Dawn tomorrow, at the earliest. The chariots can't travel very far at night.
How far to the city?
30 miles or so. About an hour by chariot.
How many people are there?
350 or so, counting the kids.
Tell us about this Metau rod.
Well, what part of me advising you to run don't you understand, Dix? You got no time for this.
Tell us.
Well, they operate on some kind of ancient principle about channeling the sacrum, the life force. You gotta be trained in how to use them. My amulet keeps my body helix from being warped.
With a forefinger, Danielson traced a line along his arms, head, and chest.
The shape of the amulet is a closed double helix energy pattern. It protects my bio-aural field from the resonating mana energies. Get it? That's why Pharaoh is building a pyramid, to increase the power of his bio-aural field, to saturate him and his queen completely with the sacrum, so they'll be immortal.
Pharaoh told you that?
Not exactly. Stockbridge said it. He said once the pyramid was built, the capstone put in place, it would draw power from the energy field of the planet, even other planets. Anybody standing inside the pyramid would be made immortal.
The old pyramid power theory. In my day, it was called electromotivism, a pseudoscience.
By my day, the theory had gained some respectability. With the translations of ancient Egyptian texts and codices, reputable scientists performed experiments and came up with empirical evidence that the old Egyptians had a kind of energy transference technology.
Ryan had completed reassembling his Sig Sauer. He tested the action, then slid a clip into the butt.
You got plenty of ammo. JB, you have any other surprises you rat-holed from the commune?
Sorry, that grin I used on Poseidon's Sekhmen was my last surprise.
We've gotten by with just our blasters on many an occasion. Guess I'll have to do this time.
Do? Do for what?
We're going to the city.
What are you, a jolt brain? Boost them chariots and get back to where you came from.
We came from the redoubt. It's a door that opens only one way at present. Your pharaoh saw to that. And there's a good reason why this region is called the Barrens, right?
Right.
There's nothing out here. No settlements, no vills, not even a pest hole outpost. Only Fort Fubar and Aten, right?
Yes.
Besides, Helize is expecting us. Far be it from me to disappoint him.
You'll be walking into a trap.
We never let that stop us before.
Nope. People try to trap us, we chill them.
See? A marvelously simple approach to the vagaries of life.
You're all crazy.
JB reached out and tapped the amulet hanging from the old man's throat.
Look who's talking.
Dean was bored with standing watch. He had patrolled up and down the sandy, heat-baked perimeter of Fort Fubar several times, squinting out into the wasteland in all directions. He saw nothing that interested him. Returning to the square, he looked over one of the chariots. Ryan stepped out of the storage building as Dean examined the simple controls.
Think you could drive one of these things, son?
Could I, Dad? That'd be a real hot pipe.
Good. The rest of us will be moving on at dawn. We'll leave one of these wags. You'll stay here.
Move on? Where?
Tersely, Ryan gave the boy an overview of Danielson's story about Pharaoh Akhenaten and the city of Aten.
Wait for us here 4 days. Then, take this wag back to the redoubt and try the gateway.
Why don't all of us do that?
I'm taking a calculated risk. It's possible that once we arrive in the city, whatever power is being directed to deactivate the gateway controls will end and be directed toward us. But there's no guarantee any of us will make it back.
Why can't I share the risk?
I won't have you deliberately strolling into a tiger trap with us.
I'll follow you.
No. You'll do what I say. Listen to me, son. If we're not back in 4 days, then more than likely, we won't be coming back. At least, not for quite a while.
We've only been back together a few weeks. It's not fair to leave me behind.
No, it isn't fair. But dragging you into a trap isn't fair either. Do you understand?
No. I'm not a kid anymore. I can make my own decisions.
Not this time. You'll stay here until we come back. Or until we don't. Now, get out of the heat and grab some grub.
Dean didn't look at him as he turned and marched toward the storage building. He passed Christy as she came out, and he evaded her patting hand as if she were contaminated. She had a Mata'u rod angled over her shoulder like a fishing pole.
Guess you told him.
Think all of us can squeeze into one of these wags?
Tight fit, but we'll manage. Better than walking. You sure this is the right idea, lover?
Hell, I'm not sure of anything. But this Hell-Eyes bastard wants you, and he's interfering with us, and he sent Sekhmen after us. I'm sick and fed the fuck up with deranged sons of bitches dogging us, no matter where we go.
Well, we're making it awfully easy for this particular deranged son of a bitch.
Why delay the inevitable? There's no place to run, and this fort is about as defensible as a strawberry patch. And even if it wasn't,
Combining Danielson's food supplies with ours still doesn't give us the provisions to hold out against a siege. But I'm open to suggestions. Christy didn't offer any. She looked away, nodding, lightly biting her lower lip. She swished the Mata'u rod in clockwise and counterclockwise swirls. Extending the V-prongs toward the chariot, a thread of light, like a static electricity discharge, popped toward the metal-rimmed wheels. You know how to operate that thing?
Bioelectric energy manipulation. The same principles of drawing on natural electromagnetic currents taught to me by my mother. Like Danielson said, it's all in knowing how to channel and focus them. You're wondering if I should stay behind with Dean.
Something like that.
Hell eyes will just come for me, you know. You said it. We'd only delay the inevitable.
But to give you up...
No choice. I'm just as sick of running as you are. He's got into my head and played with me like I was a sex puppet. Whether he's a pharaoh, god, or mutant, and whether he wants me to bear his children or warm his bed, I'll provide him with a surprise that will give him nightmares for the rest of his life.
Pretty tough talk for a sex puppet.
It is. And I mean every word of it.
Gray dawn stole over Fort Fubar when Ryan, Christy, Mildred, Doc, JB, and Jack trooped out to the chariot. Dean stood by the door and watched them pass wordlessly, not responding to Jack ruffling his hair or the kisses bestowed by Mildred and Christy.
I expect you to treat my son with hospitality, Danielson. You don't have to feed or babysit him. The food we've left should be enough so you won't have to share your own larder.
Carter, I don't mind the company. Long as he behaves himself, we'll get along fine.
It's not his behavior I'm worried about.
Don't be vulgar, Carter. I had 3 kids of my own, remember? Besides, Trader gave me the boot for putting things in my pants, not for taking things out.
Ryan nodded shortly, glancing at Dean. The boy refused to meet his gaze. The big man turned away, paused, then heeled around, unslinging the stire from his shoulder. He walked over to his son, thrusting the rifle into his hands.
I leave this in your care. You may need it for hunting game.
Okay.
We'll be back.
Dean only nodded, struggling to keep the tears bottled up. Ryan gently pushed him away and climbed into the chariot, sitting at the edge of the chassis platform, beside the solar cell array. JB engaged the drive, and with only the slightest of lurches, the vehicle rolled forward. Hands on the guide bar, JB stirred it around in a wide half circle and out into the open desert. The afternoon before, JB had experimented driving the chariot, testing its limits and capabilities. The battery charged by solar energy retained sufficient energy to keep them on their way, provided he kept the wag's speed at a moderate level. After a few minutes of scanning the desert floor with his flashlight, he found the tracks cut into the sand the day before by the incarnates. The 2 sets of parallel grooves curved ahead. The wind hadn't had the time to do more than blur the edges of the individual tracks. He notched up the rate of speed only slightly. Without the solar rays to recharge it, the storage battery would drain fast in the darkness. Around and beyond, the desert flowed out, unbroken and featureless. A rust-red sun rose, splashing the sky with variegated scraps of color. By the time it was a finger's width above the horizon, Ryan figured they had traveled about 20 miles. The desert gradually ebbed, funneling into a broad roadbed made of crushed, grit-encrusted gravel. JB steered the chariot down its middle, shifted to a higher speed, and a cloud of dust floated behind the wag. The road widened, and within 5 miles, tall palm trees began to line it on either side. JB guided the chariot toward one on the right, reaching out to slap the bark as they passed by.
What'd you do that for?
Wanted to see if it was real or not. Sure felt like it.
The road twisted between 2 heaped hillocks of sand. Vegetation sprouted from them, scraggly leaves moving slightly in the breeze. When the road straightened again, in the midst of the desolation beyond them, lay a city. JB decreased the chariot speed until it crawled to a droning halt.
Dark night.
He engaged the brake, and everyone climbed out, staring from beneath shading hands. The city was about 1/4 mile away, and it was alive with movement. The high outer walls loomed, white and massive, above the sands. The road wound past a collection of squat, low-roofed buildings and through an open gate. The stone archway above it bore bas-relief profile carvings of archers and racing chariots. Four gigantic statues of seated men wearing elaborate headdresses flanked the gate. Beyond it, people moved to and fro through an open plaza large enough to contain a small army. Around its edges fluttered the brightly colored canopies of merchants. Straight ahead, a very wide avenue ran past the plaza, guarded on either side by four great sculpted figures, representations of animals half reclining on tall rectangular pedestals. At the end of the avenue appeared to be a large building of some sort, backed up against the far wall. It was too distant to distinguish details. A chain of rocky hills rose behind the city, curving across the horizon like the fossilized vertebrae of some prehistoric monster. Green pasture land rolled to the south, and they could make out several flocks of either cattle or sheep or both. Above the west wall, a vast pyramidal structure shouldered the blue sky. It was composed of countless fitted blocks of stone, the top flat and irregular, like a row of broken teeth. The early morning light played along the white facade of the monstrous monolith. Ryan tried to estimate its size by using the city walls as a reference point. He could only hazard a feeble guess. A 40-story building rising angularly from a 13-acre base was the best he could come up with.
By the three Kennedys, this isn't Deathlands. This isn't even our time.
My readings were true. We're exactly where I said we were.
How can this be? I saw pics of places like this in books. There hasn't been a city like that in thousands of years. And never in America.
Not thousands of years, folks. More like close to 180.
Talk sense.
Remember when I said this area had been popular with filmmakers? The Holy City of Aten is a movie set built by Cecil B. DeMille back in the 1920s for the first silent version of the Ten Commandments.
Come on, Millie. How could a movie set have survived for so long in such good shape, weathering the new cost and sky dark?
I remember reading about this place. Unlike later movie sets, which were made of plaster and papier-mâché and plastic, old DeMille built this thing to last out of concrete, plaster, and limestone. When the filming was over, he figured it was cheaper to bury the whole shebang rather than dismantle it and cart it back to Hollywood. The site was lost for over 60 years. It was relocated back in the early 1990s with ground penetration radar. Best as I can remember it, plans were underway for a full excavation. Guess those plans were put on hold until Hell Eyes came along.
A movie set. Well, if it was buried, there's no reason why it couldn't have come through all the geological changes in Skydark fairly intact. How did Hell Eyes know about it?
The Redoubt had an extensive database. The story about finding the site was fairly well known, so he probably came across a reference to it while he was file browsing.
Do we ride or walk from here?
Shit. They're expecting us anyhow. Make it easy on ourselves. Let's ride.
Whatever we choose as a conveyance, the horseless chariot or our feet, let us proceed with all due caution.
Let's travel in style. If Pharaoh's going to chop our heads off, he might as well do it before the real heat of the day begins.
Once everyone was back in the vehicle, JB let it creep forward along the tree-lined road. They rolled past the outlying buildings, then toward the four identical statues of seated men, sculptures Doc identified as replicas of far larger pieces in Egypt's Abu Simbel Valley. There were sentries on the walls, and though they watched the companion's steady approach, none of them raised an alarm or hailed them with a challenge. As they drew closer to the open gate, Doc fidgeted with the lion's head of his sword stick.
Interesting how necessity forces mature human beings to do things against their better judgment.
And maybe against their wills.
With no fanfare and just as little notice, the chariot entered the city of Aten. The marketplace wasn't particularly busy so early in the morning. The merchants displayed fruit, vegetables, woven linens, pottery, and wooden kitchen utensils. There were wines and spices and even hand-loomed rugs. The merchants wore simple tunics, and their hair was cut and styled in a strange fashion, some of them sporting completely shaved pates except for a long braid, and others with long plaited hair. They were similar in their well-fed physiques and eyes that didn't once look in the direction of the rolling chariot. The women were all black-haired, their eyes outlined by equally black mascara. They walked with sensuous, graceful strides. Their diaphanous ankle-length robes slid to the thigh. Other people thronged the plaza, all lean and dark. In fact, Everyone they saw had swarthy skin and jet-black hair. In all of the marketplace, no voices spoke, shouted, or laughed. There was only a serene silence from the citizens of Aten, and that in itself was a bit frightening. A fountain bubbled and sparkled in the center of the plaza, surrounded by a stone decorated with hieroglyphics. Nearly naked children drank from it, and women filled earthenware jugs. Like everyone else, they ignored the six people as they rode past. JB drove the chariot out of the plaza and along a boulevard by the bestial statues Ryan had glimpsed earlier. They were sphinxes, anthropomorphic creatures with the bodies of lions and the heads of noble-looking men. A great, rambling, multi-terraced building loomed at the far end of the boulevard. It looked as if its walls were faced with marble and the fluted columns inlaid with gold. Ryan studied the broad steps leading up to a massive door of beaten bronze. He knew, without knowing how he knew, that Hell Eyes waited and watched from behind that heavy portal. Aten was beautiful and exceptionally clean. All of the companions had difficulty believing that it was nothing more than a huge playset, constructed for pre-dark entertainment purposes. Regardless of its origin, Aten possessed a heart and a soul, beating with the pulse of life, very strong and sensual. JB found a side lane that paralleled the Boulevard of Sphinxes. He turned the chariot down it and came to a slow halt.
This is too weird. We don't belong here, certainly not in one of their wags. Nobody's paying attention to us. Like we're invisible or ghosts.
I'm not going to complain.
They're playing some kind of game with us, pretending we're not here.
What would be its point?
To disorient us, confuse us, throw us off balance, make us doubt.
If that is so, the cooperation on the part of Aten's citizens is truly extraordinary, and an unsettling example of Pharaoh's hold over them.
JB, get us out of here!
The chariot lunged forward, and the armorer steered it down another side lane that ran at right angles along one wall. He followed it until he emerged back at the marketplace at its inner end. Only now, it was a marketplace without merchants and shoppers. It was completely deserted.
Now what?
Now they're paying attention to us.
From behind them came the sounds of many running feet. Men wearing the heads of animals efficiently fanned out in a ring around the chariot, sunlight glinting from the pronged shafts gripped in their dusky hands. The companions saw duplicates of the helmets worn by the incarnates in Fort Fubar, but new ones as well. A hippopotamus, a crocodile, a donkey, even an insect.
Hang on!
JB manipulated the chariot's controls, and it spun on one wheel in a complete circle, revolving as if on an axis. As it rotated, the Uzi fairly leapt into his hand. He played the string of 9mm rounds over the encircling incarnates, like water from a high-pressure hose. As the Uzi began its deadly stutter, Ryan and Jack leapt from the pirouetting chariot, rolling with the momentum, hitting the flagstoned ground with their guns out and working. Light flared from the tip of a Mata'u rod just as Ryan went into a sideways lunge. He felt a pins and needles tingle on the top of his left shoulder. He didn't know from which incarnate the energy bolt had come, so he shot the nearest. Jack's Colt Python fired, and the heavy .357 caliber slug broke a crocodile head and the human skull supporting it. A Mata'u rod swept toward him, and the albino's steel spring legs propelled him into a one-handed cartwheel. As his feet spun over his head, the colt belched flame again. The bug-headed incarnate slapped at his right shoulder as the bullet bit a chunk of meat and muscle out of it amid a spray of blood. Ryan kept moving, never still for a microsecond, ducking and weaving, dodging the flashing crackles of energy. The Mata'u rods flailed at him like whips. His eye caught a flicker of motion from behind him, and a double-pronged tip stabbed toward the barrel of his Sig Sauer. Ryan opened his hand. Before the Sig Sauer hit the ground, he snatched the 18-inch Panga from its sheath. A head, encased in a bird-beaked helmet, tumbled like an awkward ball to the flagstones. As the blood-spouting trunk of the incarnate toppled forward, Ryan whirled to face a hippopotamus-headed man who gaped at him in open-mouthed horror.
Come and die!
Ryan spun on his heel in the direction of the chariot. Then he was flat on his face in the dust, wondering distantly what he was doing there. His arms and legs seemed filled with half-frozen mud, and his thoughts stumbled and staggered, finally succumbing to the brief, almost subliminal image of a nimbus of energy jumping from metal prongs. Something hard and unyielding insinuated itself between Ryan's ribs and the ground. He felt no pain, only a steady pressure. He realized a foot was lifting him, turning him, rolling him onto his back. A mahogany giant towered over him, a conical jeweled headpiece bisecting the sun and adding another 6 inches to his height. The hard beauty of his face had none of the softness of youth left in it. He wore a magnificent gem-encrusted leather harness over his muscular torso. Sunlight gleamed from the golden threads worked into the white fabric of his short kilt. The giant's eyes, under straight black brows, were like drops of hot blood.
So, I didn't frighten you away after all. Perhaps I'll have to try harder next time.
The bronzed giant kicked him in the head, kicked him down into a spiraling black hole. 3 animal-helmeted men then turned savage eyes on Jack, and he saw 3 more racing to flank him. He knew he had only 4 rounds for 6 rapidly moving targets.
Take him alive!
Easy to say, Stoop.
Jack pivoted on his heel, put his head back, and started to run. He raced across the plaza. He ran down the narrow side lane that JB had followed, then up a narrow alley, hardly wide enough to accommodate his slight frame. The much larger incarnates would find it difficult and painful to negotiate. Emerging into a broad street, he spotted a stone stair leading to the roof of a building. He loped up the steps, taking 3 at a time. Running at full sprint across the flat surface of the roof, he took an alleyway yawning before him in a single leap. He dashed across the top of the building and jumped over another alley. Down a few feet to a tiled rooftop. Only then did he pause to look back and catch his breath. Though the early morning sun wasn't even at midpoint in the sky, the blazing heat and the exertion had already drenched him in sweat. He considered removing his camouflage clothing, not only because of its weight, but because there was nothing in sight to use as decent cover. At any rate, his white skin and ruby eyes couldn't be disguised. He listened intently, but he heard very little. He had lost his pursuers.
Phew.
Swinging over the edge of the roof, he dropped down into the street below, landing lightly in a crouch. He moved along the street warily, trying to stay close to the sparse shadows. The street funneled into a lane, then narrowed to an alley. As Jack walked, he encountered no one, not even a dog. He crept along the alley, holding his gun and unsheathing one of his flat, leaf-bladed throwing knives. If he ran into trouble, he didn't want to pinpoint his position by firing the Colt. Jack had no plan except to evade capture. Escaping the city and leaving his friends behind never entered his mind.
The evening river's calm and still, the evening flowers drink their fill. The north wind comes to cool the night and put the river's waves to flight.
A very small space, 15 inches wide between 2 of the buildings, was the only bolt hole available. As thin as he was, it was a struggle to cram himself in sideways, pushing himself back from the alley. He waited, staring out with slitted eyes, his thumb resting on the razor-keen edge of his knife.
The ripples wash the moon away and will not let the starlight stay.
A nearly naked girl strode down the alley, her slender body draped in the filmiest of coverings. Her heavy black hair was as shiny as a raven's wing and rested on her shoulders. Impudent breasts swayed beneath the thin material. She carried a water jug in one hand, and she walked as she sang. Jack stared, entranced by the girl's grace, sensual beauty, and sweet voice. She passed out of sight. So Jack worked his way back out of the opening. Because of the scrape of his clothing on the walls, he didn't hear the faint scrabbling of feet until he poked his head out. A hand closed over his long hair in an agonizingly tight grip, and a tremendous, muscle-wrenching jerk catapulted him out into the alleyway. He slashed backward and blindly with his knife, feeling the tip drag through flesh. The hand, which was tangled in his hair, opened, and Jack flung himself into a forward somersault. He came out of it on one knee, blade held between thumb and index finger, arm cocked for a throw. He stared into the double prongs of a Mata'u rod, the V only inches away from his face. He didn't hesitate. His leg muscles propelled him in a sideways lunge to the left. He wasn't able to see if or where the knife struck because his optic nerves were suddenly overwhelmed by a flare of light. Jack hit the ground with all the grace of a piece of cordwood. His entire left side was numb, the only sensation a dull prickly creeping under the flesh. His vision cleared fast, though, and he saw the incarnate staring with foolish eyes at the knife hilt vibrating in his breast. A red line of blood shone on his ribs, where Jack had nicked him. Slowly, the bull-helmeted man dropped to his knees, the Mata'u rod falling to the street dust.
I am the incarnation of Serapis. Tell me this is not happening to Serapis.
Jack clawed himself forward by the strength of his right arm. His head pounded, like sharp hammers were beating on the inside of his skull. He fought his way to his feet. The buildings tilted and spun all around him.
Stoop. Trip a stoop.
He fixed his eyes on the nearest doorway, 6 yards or 6,000 miles away. He stumbled, reeled, and fell into it, leaning his entire weight against the door. The door suddenly opened behind Jack, pulled from the inside, and he lost what remained of his balance, very nearly falling flat on his back. The hands clutching his arm and holding him more or less upright were small, brown, and strong. A gray-eyed, pink-lipped, black-haired girl held him tightly, and it took him a dazed moment to recognize her. She was the girl with the water jug and the sweet song. His hands made an automatic slap for his knives or his gun. The girl restrained him easily. Though she was about his height, she was astonishingly strong, or he was exceptionally weak. She tugged him away from the door so she could shut and latch it.
No, I will not harm you. I want to be your friend.
Who are you?
My name is Kalo. What is your name?
Jack.
He dived headlong into a deep black well.
Are you sure he still sleeps?
Yes, I gave him the right dosage.
Jack felt like he was floating. He could feel the jostling vibration of a moving vehicle. He felt a warm breath caress his right ear.
Jack, can you hear me?
He tried to answer, but he couldn't feel or even find his tongue. He could move neither his arms nor legs, nor did he care to do so. He was very warm. He was very comfortable. He felt no pain, and he was in a good place.
Very good. Sleep, then.
Baron Termaw and the General had turned the West Lowellton Holiday Inn into a casino, and they asked Jack to be the croupier at the craps table. He agreed before he realized that all the dice were carved from the bones of his father, Christina, and his darling Jenny. He was ashamed that he had forgotten that the Baron had murdered his father, and the General was responsible for killing his wife and child. So Jack turned and ran through the old hotel, seeking out the humid comfort of his beloved bayou. But he couldn't find the door. He wandered through dark tunnels toward a dim, distant light, only to find himself walking deeper and deeper into the black. At last he emerged into a tomb. Cobwebs hung in the corners, and they fluttered toward his face. He tasted the dust of centuries on his tongue, and he entered another door, scared and sweating. He found himself sitting in a little amphitheater, looking down at a small central stage. Two naked girls danced to music only they could hear, their beautiful bodies twirling and pirouetting, tossing their heavy black hair. They touched each other as they danced, fingers playfully darting here and there, and they kept stealing shy glances toward him, as if seeking his approval. Jack applauded, feeling an admiration, a lust, and almost a love for the girls, who danced with such wild abandon for his pleasure. One of the girls stopped dancing and pointed at him with a long finger.
You are awake.
A damp cloth lay across Jack's forehead. The pungent smell of herbs entered his nostrils and seemed to push back the nausea boiling in his stomach, and with each whiff, strength seemed to return to his limbs. A hand cradled the back of his head, the rim of a cup pressed against his lips.
Drink this.
Unhesitatingly, Jack swallowed the liquid. It was warm and tasted strongly of copper, like mustard greens mixed with honey. The cup was removed. Carefully, he opened his eyes and saw a girl's face leaning over him. She was the same gray-eyed young woman who had pulled him into the house. The bare-walled room was lit by tapers. He tried to rise. She pressed a hand gently against his shoulder, pushing him back against the soft cushions beneath his body. Memory slowly seeped back to him.
Kayla?
Yes, my name is Kayla. Your name is Jack. You are among friends.
My friend. Where are they?
They are in the custody of Pharaoh.
Kayla glanced up and to her left, and another woman stepped into Jack's field of vision. She was very tall and slim, with a touch of arrogance stamped on her stirringly beautiful face. Both women wore thin, loosely woven tunics that seemed like cobwebs, barely a concession to clothing.
I am Nephron. I will help you and all of your people if you will but trust me.
You have been brought to a safe house. No one will find you here. You must have been unconscious all day and for the better part of the night. You must stay here and regain your strength.
I feel fine now. My things. Where?
There. On that footstool. Your weapons, even your knives, are safe.
Jack started to stand, but a wave of dizziness crashed over him. He felt himself falling, but Nephron and Kayla caught him by the arms, steadied him, and lowered him back onto the pallet.
Do not be an idiot. You are still very weak.
I know that now. Thanks.
What is your full name?
Jack Lauren.
Listen to me, Jack Lauren. Life is very complex here in the kingdom. It will soon become even more complex. You must stay here, out of sight, until certain plans are laid and come to fruition. I or Kayla will keep you advised as to the progression.
Progression?
I have a plan to get you and your friends safely out of here, but you must trust me. It all has to come together perfectly. All of you must go, or none of you will go. Do you understand? Do you understand?
Yeah.
I will not be able to visit you very often. Kayla will attend to your needs and carry messages. To me and from me.
I want to see my friends.
Oh, that is not possible, Jack Lauren. However, it is possible to get messages to them. And that will have to suffice.
Nephron turned and strode away into a darkened foyer.
Who, Nephron?
She is my princess. I do her bidding. She holds the key.
Well.
Are you in pain?
Not exactly.
In discomfort, then?
Little, yeah.
Nephron charged me with attending to your comfort.
Kayla's hands went to his belt, unbuckling it so swiftly and deftly, he had no opportunity to say anything. When her fingers undid the snapcatch on his pants, Jack decided there was no point in saying anything. Instead, he reached for her. Ryan opened his eye, and at first saw nothing. He felt a surge of panic, wondering if he had been struck blind, but when he shifted his head, he caught a yellow glimmer of dim light. He stirred feebly, and the motion sent a hot bar of pain drilling through his chest to his back. By degrees, he turned his head and again caught the glow of light, and by it, he squinted at his surroundings. He was in a tiny, bare-walled chamber, hardly large enough to accommodate the narrow, very hard cot he was lying on. The cot was made of woven reeds that exuded a musty vegetable odor. Craning his neck, he saw that one wall of the room was covered by a latticework of wooden bars, the crosspieces bound with rawhide thongs. The door was hinged on the outside and secured by a crude padlock and hasp. He smiled humorlessly. Not a room, a cell. The floor and walls were of old stone. A bucket occupied one corner. The light peeking in between the bars was provided by a guttering torch. With a trembling hand, he fingered the tacky patch of drying blood on the right side of his head.
Ah! Damn it.
Ryan, good fellow, are you awake? John Barrymore, can you see if he's awake?
Ryan, are you all right in there?
No, but I can manage.
Slowly, Ryan levered himself to a sitting position, and after enduring a wave of vertigo, he realized that he was naked.
Christy, you okay, lover?
I regret to say she is not among us, nor is young Master Lauren.
Where are they?
No idea. All of us in the chariot were knocked on our collective asses by those Matao weapons. We came to a few minutes ago. You must have been hit harder than the rest of us, or you were still weak from the shot you took yesterday.
Or Hell Eyes kicked me in the head as an added little bonus for not being scared away.
Gazing through the bars, he saw Doc, JB, and Mildred, all in identical cells and all naked. Doc, tall and always skeletally lean, looked pathetically vulnerable. He kept both hands clasped discreetly over his groin. JB looked a bit ludicrous too, wearing nothing but his sallow skin and spectacles. Mildred stood with one arm crooked over her breasts and her hands spread at the juncture of her thighs. The four cells formed the transverse bar of a T. JB's cell faced the juncture corridor.
Was Christy in the chariot with you?
Yes. It is safe to assume she and Jack were separated from us for some reason.
Any idea where we are?
No. Came to in here, as naked as a newborn babe.
We could be in ancient Egypt, for all we know. Buried in a hidden chamber in the Pyramid of Giza.
Oh, don't go all jolt-brained on us.
I have no intention of doing so. However, you may have noticed how the citizens of Aten appeared to be of Egyptian origin. All dark-haired and dark-skinned. Not an Anglo-Saxon in the bunch. The odds of Pharaoh finding only that physical type in the barons are so astronomical that they are not even worth discussing.
You're forgetting where we are.
I believe that was my topic, Dr. Wyeth.
We're in a movie set, Doc. In some remnant of California, not Egypt, ancient or otherwise. And if this is a movie set, it's basically an illusion. And therefore, the so-called Egyptians we saw are probably the product of hair and skin dyes to maintain the illusion for Pharaoh's benefit.
Oh, pray proceed.
I got a good look at the citizens of Aten. Regardless of their coloring, their body and facial structures are not the Egyptian norm. I saw a few blue eyes in the mix, too.
So this is just some big play-acting set for Hell Eyes, is that what you're saying?
Not exactly. He's gone to a great deal of trouble to evoke the look of the 18th dynasty. So it's more than just a fantasy land to him. We've got to take it seriously because he takes it seriously.
Shh!
They could hear the sounds of sandaled feet coming down the corridor. A moment later, two tall men walked into the cell block area. They were dusky-skinned with completely shaved heads. Gold earrings glinted in the flickering torchlight. Both were dressed identically in simple linen tunics. One of them carried a long metal key attached to a strap looped around his right waist. They glanced impersonally into each cell, stopped in front of the lock to Mildred's door, and inserted a key into the lock.
What are you doing?
Listen, how long are we supposed to stay here? Why don't you tell your Pharaoh that we came here to see him?
He knows that.
I want to talk to him.
Whatever you assholes are selling, I'm not in the market.
This is no time for insolence.
The turnkey stepped in, reaching out for her. Mildred struck at him with her clenched fist. The turnkey, with a skill of long practice, twisted away from the punch and caught her wrist. He wrenched her arm up between her shoulder blades. The turnkey's companion cuffed her brutally on the side of the head with an open hand. JB reached between the bars, clawing for the turnkeys, pulling Mildred to her feet, both of her arms pinioned behind her, and a grip she remembered was called the police come-along. She allowed herself to be manhandled out of the cell. She made no further resistance, but rage smoldered in her dark eyes. JB swatted for the nearer man, but his fingers fell inches short of a target.
Calm down, Shorty. We aren't going to hurt her unless she forces the issue.
Where are the rest of our people? The red-haired woman and the albino kid?
They offered no response, marching Mildred between them, down the corridor and out of sight.
Don't become despondent, John Barrymore. I believe we can take their word at face value. They will not harm her.
I don't suppose they left you your sword stick.
Alas, no.
I thought maybe since they let me keep my glasses.
An obvious physical infirmity, as is Ryan's vision. When I was stripped, I surmise they found no reason I should need a walking stick.
J.B. slumped against the bars, hanging his head like a sick dog.